ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of December. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, with contentious laws on the table after the Bondi terror attack, what more can be done to prevent young people from being radicalised? And President Donald Trump's plan to build a golden fleet of battleships. But will they ever set sail?
These are the best in the world. They'll be the fastest, the biggest, and by far 100 times more powerful than any battleship ever built.
There's a lot you could say about it, but it's probably not worth it because these ships will never be built.
The political fallout from the Bondi terror attack continues, with pressure still mounting on the federal government to call a royal commission. In New South Wales, a controversial bill to strengthen gun controls and ban mass protests has passed the state's lower house. And in Victoria, the Premier has announced a raft of measures to address anti-Semitism, including targeting protesters and online hate speech. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Sweeping reforms in the wake of the Bondi terror attack passed the New South Wales lower house late last night.
There being 59 votes for the ayes and only 15 votes for the noes, I declare the motion carried.
Premier Chris Minns told the House he bears responsibility for ensuring Jewish people feel safe and protected.
It's hard to take the hate out of somebody's heart. That doesn't mean we don't have a duty to do everything we possibly can to fight hatred in our community, wherever and whenever we see it.
Among the reforms are restrictions on protest activity and increased police powers to remove face coverings at public assemblies. As debate moves to the upper house today, an alliance of activist, political and civil liberty groups say they'll mount a legal challenge against these measures. Josh Lees represents the Palestine Action Group.
These laws will take away the rights of everyone in New South Wales to gather together as a community, to express their views, to express their opposition to whatever government policy they oppose, to demand change.
Anne Toomey is a constitutional law expert and Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney.
So the problem here is that potentially it's a little bit too broad. It's not sufficiently narrowly focused on connecting the effect of the law with the purpose of protecting the public.
She says the new laws dictate the Commissioner of Police or Deputy Commissioner may only limit assembly if they're satisfied the protest could cause a reasonable person to fear things like harassment, intimidation or violence.
But the problem with that is that that's only in relation to the holding of public assemblies generally within that area. So it picks up all public assemblies in that area. And so you have to say, well, if you had a declaration in relation to the whole of the state of New South Wales, could you say that, you know, the holding of public assemblies generally give rise to a reasonable person to fear harassment, intimidation or violence? It becomes a bit weird because it's not focused down upon particular public assembly.
Anne Toomey says the new laws could even have the unintended consequence of leading to more unauthorised protests.
What this law does is it takes away the ability to have your public assembly authorised. You can still legally hold a public assembly, but if the people block roads or, you know, impede people's movement in public places, then they can be prosecuted for doing that.
In Victoria, Premier Jacinta Allen has announced a broad range of measures to address anti-Semitism, including placing its own limits on protest activity and holding social media companies to account for online hate speech shared on their platforms.
It's as complex a challenge as we have ever faced, but its principle is quite straightforward: anti-hate. Consistent restorative action to reverse the spread of hate.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has apologised to the Jewish community for what they experienced in the Bondi terror attack. But the Commonwealth is so far resisting calls for a royal commission. Richard Marles is the Deputy Prime Minister.
Royal commissions take years and we need to be acting within weeks. It's really as simple as that.
The coalition is continuing to criticise the federal government's response to Bondi. Opposition leader Susan Lee accused Foreign Minister Penny Wong of not shedding a tear in the wake of the attack, an accusation federal Labor MP and Minister for Climate Change and Energy Chris Bowen described as disgusting.
Susan Lee is not the arbiter of grief or mourning, and she does not get to decide how people express that mourning.
Speaking to Channel 7 this morning, Susan Lee defended her comments.
It was me expressing my anger and disappointment on behalf of the community to the government.
While the federal government is not committing to a royal commission, the Prime Minister has announced a review into intelligence and law enforcement agencies led by former bureaucrat Dennis Richardson to be completed by April.
Bridget Fitzgerald there. Speaking outside New South Wales Parliament today, Premier Chris Minns says the legislation, including tougher protest laws, are vital for keeping the community safe.
In some cases, words lead to actions. Now, I've seen resistance to the government's legislative agenda in recent days, and I understand the concepts behind it, but I want to make the point that in virtually all aspects of government policy, there's an acknowledgement that words lead to actions. We hear it all the time. We accept that it's true. But if that's the case as an idea or a concept, then that must be the situation as it applies to protests in New South Wales. How can it be that a protest can take place in the state and there's a swastika tattooed on the Star of David on a poster in the middle of the city?
As part of its reforms, the federal government wants to introduce a new aggravating offence aimed at adults who seek to radicalise and influence children. The Attorney-General, Michelle Rowland, says since 2001, 120 people have been convicted of terrorism offences and 10 of them were children. I spoke to Dr. Levi West from the Australian National University, who's an internationally recognised authority on terrorism and counter-terrorism, and he's been researching radicalisation. Dr. West, thank you for joining us. How are children being radicalised in Australia?
I mean, what we know about children and radicalisation is that the process itself is not distinct from that of anyone being radicalised. There are some unique characteristics. What we know across the board is that the online environment writ large plays an increasingly central role in the radicalisation of anyone, but especially young people.
And are people reaching out to them on social media, building relationships? Is that how it happens?
I think making sort of generalisations about how it happens is a very dangerous process. It is a really highly individualistic and highly specific process. There is as many cases of it being a predatory exercise where someone who's committed to an ideology seeks people and recruits people into violent extremism, as much as it is likely that someone is discovering it by their own volition. If someone decides that they want to access ideological content online, they will often then, through whatever process they go through, seek some kind of validation from an in-real-life person.
What ages are the children who are being caught up in this?
Yeah. So outside of government, there's not great data on that, in part because seeing data on people who haven't gone through with violence but have become engaged with extremism is a very difficult thing to measure. What we do know is that intermittently there is a lowest age person of interest number that's put out into the public. And over the last few years, we've heard ages as young as 12 and 11 becoming involved in violent extremism. Now, that's not committing terrorist attacks or engaging in violence. That's engaging with the ideology, accessing content online, etc.
What is the danger of children as young as 11 and 12 being radicalised? What then is the risk as they grow up?
So probably the single greatest challenge that youth radicalisation presents is that unlike a mature adult becoming involved in violent extremism, where they are overwhelmingly need to be understood as a perpetrator of some kind of harm. When we're dealing with children, when we're dealing with 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds, these are often both potential perpetrators of violence but also victims of something that resembles a grooming exercise. And so one of the most significantly difficult and challenging parts of dealing with youth extremism, or rather youth radicalisation, is how we manage the balancing act between ensuring both that they don't pose a risk to society more broadly, but at the same time we manage the duty of care that is owed to a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old as a victim. The one thing that gives us a degree of solace is that the overwhelming majority of people, children, youth or otherwise, that radicalise never go through with committing violence. We can be reasonably comfortable that it is very, very, very unusual for terrorist violence to take place. Even, you know, a week and a half out from Bondi, it's important that we keep that in mind.
What needs to change then in your perspective?
I think there's probably two things that need to be done with some degree of urgency. The first of those is, and some of this will come out in the review that Dennis Richardson's been tasked with completing, which is to ensure that our counterterrorism apparatus is appropriately fit for purpose, that it is adequately funded and resourced. The other one, and I think this sits in a much broader sort of context of challenges around not just security policy, but government policy writ large, which is that, you know, talking to experts, we have a couple of world-class youth radicalization experts in this country, and making sure that those voices are being listened to by government is probably the most important thing we can do on any of these kinds of challenges.
Counterterrorism expert Dr. Levi West from the Australian National University. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Investigations are underway into the death of a Russian general killed by a car bomb in Moscow. It's the latest in a string of high-profile assassinations of Russian military officers and public figures since the Russia-Ukraine war started almost 4 years ago. Nicole Johnston reports.
There's been a brazen attack in the heart of Moscow. A car bomb exploded outside an area full of apartments, less than 15 kilometres from the Kremlin. The target, one of Russia's top military leaders.
General Suvorov is, I think, the third or fourth high-ranking military official that has met an untimely death this year.
Charles Kapchin is Professor of International Relations at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Council for Foreign Relations.
We don't yet have confirmation from the Ukrainians that they were behind it, but I think it's a fairly safe bet that this was an operation carried out by Ukrainian operatives, and it is part of a Ukrainian strategy of finding ways to hit back at Russia.
Moscow is suggesting Ukraine is behind the attack. Svetlana Petrenko, a spokesperson for Russia's Investigations Committee.
The inspection of the scene is ongoing. Investigators will order the necessary examinations, including forensic and explosive analysis, one of which involves the possible role of Ukrainian intelligence services in organising the crime.
Charles Kapchin again.
It's also an attack that I think is meant to bring the war home to the Russian population, to average Russian citizens. Because one of the things that Putin has tried to do is cordon Russian society off from the war. In general, if you walk down the streets of Moscow or St. Petersburg, you would not know that the biggest land war since World War II is raging in Ukraine.
But if you're one of Russia's more than 1.3 million active duty military personnel, the war is close to home. In a series of text messages sent to The World Today, former Russian soldier Vladimir has provided a rare insight into the war.
Yes, Russia could agree to peace, but I think this will no longer happen, and the stated goals and objectives will be achieved by another means. Russia will not give up its territories.
Asked about what he was paid to fight, Vladimir said,
although amounts were mentioned to me, I didn't think about money. My card with the payments was with my father. I didn't count the money and didn't use it while I was there.
Vladimir explained why he joined to fight, repeating the Kremlin's false claim that its war with Ukraine is aimed at stamping out Nazism.
I'm a native Muscovite, and for me, this was a challenge. I understood the whole situation and my desire to help my brothers, my inner patriotism, intolerance, and hostility towards fascism prevented me from watching calmly from the outside.
Last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin denied reports in the West that Russia was planning to attack Europe. And the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has also rejected a news report that US intelligence believes President Vladimir Putin aims to take all of Ukraine and restore parts of the Soviet empire in Europe.
Nicole Johnston there. The United States Navy will build a new Trump-class warship as part of a White House push to modernise its fleet. President Donald Trump says they'll be the best in the world, but some experts doubt they'll ever set sail. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
He's at Mar-a-Lago for the holidays, and today US President Donald Trump announced a gift of sorts for America's military might.
I have approved a plan for the Navy to begin the construction of two brand new, very large, largest we've ever built, battleships. These are the best in the world. They'll be the fastest, the biggest, and by far 100 times more powerful than any battleship ever built.
It's being called the Golden Fleet. The president says construction will start with two ships almost immediately and be scaled up to 10. He says eventually they'll be up to 25.
Once completed, these new 30 to 40,000 ton plus vessels will be the flagships of the American naval fleet.
And as for their arsenal,
in terms of guns and missiles at the highest level, they'll also have hypersonic weapons, many hypersonic weapons, state-of-the-art electric railguns, and even the high-powered lasers that you've been starting to read about. We have lasers where you aim the laser at a target and it just wipes it out. They'll also carry the nuclear-armed, sea-launched cruise missiles currently under development, which will be instituted pretty quickly, but they're under development and they've proven to be extremely lethal.
Pete Hegseth is the U.S. Secretary of War. He doubled down on the notion of peace through strength.
You can talk about it, or you can invest in it, and you can build it. And that's exactly what President Trump is doing.
Mark Kantsian is a retired Marine colonel and senior advisor for the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He has serious reservations about the plan.
The part on shipbuilding was quite extraordinary. Describing a new class of battleships that's so unlike everything that the Navy has built for the last really 80 years. And I finally came to the conclusion that there's a lot you can say about it, but it's probably not worth it because these ships will never be built.
He says there are a number of reasons why he believes the proposed fleet isn't viable.
This new battleship would be 3 to 4 times the size of the large surface combatant that we're building right now. It would require an extraordinary design effort and would be very, very expensive.
How much say do you think the U.S. Navy has had in this announcement? And how much say do you think they'll have moving forward in executing Donald Trump's vision?
I think they had very little say in this decision because it goes so much against what they've done in the past and where they've said they wanted to go into the future. So this sounds like something that was developed in the White House.
How much influence will they be able to have in sitting down with the president and saying, look, you've delivered this vision, but it's actually quite unrealistic. We can't meet that specification.
That's going to be a very difficult conversation. I think that they'll do their preliminary homework and design and then go back to starting with the Secretary of the Navy and working their way up and say, okay, we've done the preliminary designs, and this is what we see. It's going to take 7 years. The lead ship's going to cost over $10 billion. You know, do you really want to do this? You know, we recommend an alternative path.
Mark Kantsian from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. Domestic and family violence is a major threat over the Christmas period, with women and children most at risk. The demand for support services is already high, with some services forced to turn people away. But one domestic violence survivor is working to help others by building temporary housing for those who need it. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
On a small empty block of land in regional Victoria, domestic violence survivor Katie has plans for something big. We're not using her real name to protect her identity.
This is the property that we would really, really love. We could fit probably about 8 houses on here. We were really close to a shopping centre, so it's within walking distance for women and children.
Her new project called Little Greenhouses plans to build dozens of modular homes, each one taking just 3 weeks to build. She says it'll provide quick and easy safe havens for those desperate to escape domestic and family violence, led by non-for-profit organisation Global Sisters.
Well, modular housing is like if you think of Lego. So they put them together in these great big warehouses. So you're thinking of 2-bedroom homes with, of course, kitchen, dining area, and then they put them all together.
Katie knows better than most how high the demand is for housing around this time of year.
I remember just sort of thinking, you know, what are my plans for when he gets abusive? Like, what do I do? It's something that no woman should have to be thinking about at any time, let alone through Christmas.
Rates of domestic and family violence are increasing. Statistics from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows 1 in 4 women has experienced violence from an intimate partner since the age of 15. Police say the Christmas period is the most prevalent time for family violence because families come into increased contact with perpetrators who use this time as an opportunity to control and harm their victims. In the Northern Territory, rates of domestic and family violence are among the worst in the world. Anna Aitchison is the CEO of Dawn House Women's Shelter in Darwin.
We are always at capacity. We have wait lists for our counselling, wait lists for our transitional housing and for our housing pathways. I did my annual report this year and I saw that there were an additional 800 women and children this year that we turned away compared to last year.
Dr. Wei Mei Su is with the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners as Chair for Special Interests, Abuse and Violence in Families. She says it's always a busy time of year for her practice in Sydney.
Most of the celebrations centre around family. Sometimes families aren't joyous, and forcing that gender expectation can sometimes contribute to greater tension and distress. The other challenge is that services often are in shutdown period over this time. And so families which may have been supported throughout this year may lose that during this time.
Ms Sue helps educate GPs across Australia to recognise the signs of abuse and how to give immediate support to those in need.
One thing I would really like to see the federal support into the primary health network's integration with DV services and general practitioners. At the moment, it's only rolled out to certain primary health network.
Minister for Social Services Tanya Plibersek says the government has allocated $4 billion to frontline services.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting, and if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. For border towns around Australia, managing local issues while obeying the different rules and regulations of two states can be a logistical nightmare. It's prompted some states to appoint a cross-border commissioner to smooth over some of those issues. In Queensland, the role was created last year, but the untimely death of the man in charge has left some communities in limbo. Aisling Brennan reports.
Living in a cross-border community, towns that straddle state lines, can be a little complicated. It's why a cross-border commissioner was created last year for communities along the Queensland border with New South Wales, South Australia and Northern Territory. Former police union president Ian Leavers got the job and was in the role until his death last month. Lawrence Springborg is the mayor of Gundawindi, a town which sits on the border.
And he was really kicking some goals. He was the right person for the job. He embedded himself in our community, basically became a part of our community in around about 12 to 18 months. And not only here, of course, right to Tweed Heads, you had Tanafield, Liston, Stanthorpe, Mungindi, St George, Mount Isa and right into the Northern Territory.
The Queensland State Government role called for a person who would push for improved economic and social outcomes for cross-border communities and has a priority on building disaster management capacity.
His job was to try to actually just bring together the myriad of discombobulated, you know, different rules and regulations across the border and to escalate that to the Premier's office and say, can we start to get agreed legislative change between the two jurisdictions?
Ian Leavers was a former policeman and worked closely with Gundawindi's officer in charge, Senior Sergeant Richard McIntosh. He says there was a history of criminals fleeing into New South Wales to avoid arrest in Queensland.
We, and this is going back 12 months ago, we had an offender that we wanted for 12 armed robberies in Gundawindi. He could wave to us at the street in Broggabilla as we drove past. We couldn't do anything about it, but, and that's what we're trying to address.
Senior Sergeant McIntosh says there are some powers called special constable powers which work across the borders, but there are some loopholes which allow offenders to avoid being caught.
But we've got no powers for anything that occurs in Queensland and they go back to New South Wales. If they go back to New South Wales and they're under restraint, we can't readily go over and bring that person back to Queensland.
Lawrence Springborg, former leader of the LNP, says law and order is only one aspect of the cross-border commissioner's role.
You're basically, it was like Mars and Venus down here. It's like two separate planets. It's like separate universes even.
And he's urging the LNP state government to fill the role quickly to ensure there's no progress lost.
It's just been such a terrible tragedy, and hopefully the best thing we can do for Ian and his legacy is to actually pick up where he left off and just continue it.
There hasn't been a new cross-border commissioner appointed yet, but the Premier's office says the Office of the Cross-Border Commissioner is still working to progress issues raised by border communities.
Aisling Brennan reporting, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Stephanie Smale.